Where a big box store might sell a gallon of milk for $3, an upscale natural food store might sell the gallon for $8. To sell the milk, each store must present an argument as to why theirs is the best value. This leads us to ask, which is most likely to get a person to buy a brand? Fear or guilt?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1207th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Lisbon who are tuned in to the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Or whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, food is a $5.75 trillion business in which whoever has the strongest argument will likely get the most money. Consequent to this competition, sellers use many arguments to get money from buyers. Let's take that gallon of milk, for example, which a big box store might sell for $3, while an upscale natural food store might sell for $8. The big box store's argument is very simple. Our milk is cheap. The upscale natural food store's argument is also simple. Our milk is best. The question then becomes, how do both stores contend for the dollars with their arguments? One way to get consumers to buy the brand is to bully them. For example, you could tell mothers that $3 milk contains bad chemicals that will harm their children, or you could tell mothers that buying the $8 milk is just foolish waste of the money, family's money. Given the huge amount of money at stake, food bullying has become pretty much the norm up and down the nation's food chain. And so today we pause to ask, which is most likely to get a person to buy a brand? Fear or guilt? To find an answer today, we are heading out to the heartland for a visit with Michelle Payne, author of Food Bullying, How to Avoid Buying BS. Michelle, welcome to the food chain.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, what do you mean what we think you mean by not buying BS?
Well, I actually am talking about bullspeak, so I have no idea what you're referencing. And really, bullspeak is about all of the misinformation, disinformation, and marketing BS that's on our food labels today.
Okay. And the other use of BS is probably appropriate for that as well, correct?
Perhaps, but my title happens to refer to bullspeak.
Okay, we'll stick to bullspeak. You know, Governor Gavin Newsom just signed a bill this week, I think, outlawing the shaming of school students into paying for their school luncheon. Is shaming bullying?
I would certainly say shaming falls on the food bullying spectrum, which I outline in the food bullying book, as does fear, as does guilt. The reality is that food should not have emotional value attached to it. It should be about nourishment and safety when you get back to the basics.
Mm-hmm. But it always seems to have the other connotations attached to them somehow, and perhaps that's what we'll get to today. I was always curious, I would like to ask, did you have an epiphany about food bullying someplace along the line? An incident, an occurrence in which you thought, man, I just have to do a book on this.
Well, I'm a third-time author, and as such, I'm not sure you ever really say, I just have to do a book on this, because there are a lot of work. But in all seriousness, I've been working on connecting farm and food for the last 18 years. And my first book, No More Food Fights, really focuses on how to have a civilized conversation, as you might guess. And then the second book that was just released a couple years ago is called Food Truths from Farm to Table. And as I was writing that book about the 25 various truths throughout the grocery store and shared tremendous amount of stories from farmers and ranchers and dietitians and veterinarians and the like, it became fairly apparent to me that we are having our thoughts around food manipulated, and that there's a great deal of misinformation about how food is grown, fear-mongering, if you will, about how food is grown. And you combine that with the marketing and the psychology and the neuromarketing that's happening, it really led me to take a look at some of the ways that our thoughts around food are being manipulated. And that landed me upon food bullying, which I committed to write about a year ago. So it was on a fairly fast timeline, if you're familiar with the publishing world.
Yes, I am. That's pretty fast. A year?
Yes.
A year in light speed. I had a wonderful conversation with a gal who wrote about growing up within the strawberry industry and her fight to get rid of methyl bromide. And it took 10 years to write that story. So when you say 1 year, that's pretty fast stuff. But
yeah, and it's easier the third time around, I would say. And because this topic, I've spent so much time researching, I knew going into what ideas I wanted to frame.
There you go. And it's pretty clear cut. But is there a difference between marketing and bullying?
I think that's really left up to the user and how it's perceived. So bullying operates on fear. And fear comes from what you don't trust, and you don't trust what you don't know. So the reality is that 98.5% of people in the United States don't live on a farm or ranch today. Most studies show that people haven't been on a farm in the last 5 years. So, of course, they don't necessarily know farming or ranching, and they don't trust it, and as such, they fear it. So then when you start slapping labels on food, such as, quote, farm-raised, unquote, it builds these questions, or the non-GMO label, or ethically raised, or all natural. Labels that aren't meaningful and measurable, as I like to talk about in the book, that really lack distinction and definition.
And therefore, are they different, marketing and bullying? It seems like they're pretty much the same to me, only maybe a degree difference or so.
I think bullying is when you try to push your thoughts on someone else and where you expect them to adhere to groupthink. Of course, bullying includes physical threats, attacks, or social media, excluding people from activities. So food bullying really goes beyond just the food label and the food marketing. It goes into cyberbullying. It goes into emotional bullying. It goes into what parents like to do to each other and guilting each other, particularly in the mom crowd. I can say that as a mom. I've seen farmers bully each other as well. So it's more than marketing, in my opinion, and food bullying has become an epidemic. One of the things that we talk about on the Food Bullying podcast is how food bullying has removed choice. And we actually had a woman on there who is formerly homeless, still on the SNAP program, and had to figure out how to feed her toddler son when she was homeless. She talked about, as an example, of what the legislation that did, the ballot initiative that started out in California, or was in California, I should say, around eggs and chicken housing, and what that's done to increase egg prices, which is a fundamental nutritional building block as far as protein for most parents. So bullying is much bigger than marketing.
Wow. So it's almost like marketing warfare.
I would say that bullying, again, goes beyond marketing, that it's almost become a mindset, because when you back away from it and you look very big picture, it comes down to information literacy and critical thinking. And those are skill sets that could be applied across any arena in this nation, especially politics.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the inability that it seems many people have to find compromise and disagreement, it has a great deal to do with human behavior and psychology, and honestly how our brains are being manipulated many times without us knowing it.
Well, it seems like bullying then could be something as simple as going into a restaurant and seeing Michael Olson over there eating a chicken fried steak and going up to him and saying, "I don't believe you're eating a chicken fried steak. You should be eating broccoli." Something like that, right?
Well, I think bullying can also be on the restaurant menu. When you look at the claims that are often ludicrous that are on a restaurant menu, so as a dairy person, I don't think that it is responsible to call a cheese more ethically raised or more responsibly raised, because what makes your milk more ethically raised or responsibly raised than mine? Or another proven neuromarketing technique is the way that the restaurants list their prices. So as an example, a written out price, if a food is priced at $15, and rather than using the number, they use the spelled out word 15, that's because they have actually found people are more willing to pay because it's a higher perceived value to your brain.
But is that...
Those are the types of bullying.
Huh. I would think that would be marketing, just in the presentation of the price. But I guess it could be bullying.
Again, I think it's a mix. And I think that it's behavior-based.
That would almost be a way of shaming somebody by presenting a price at, written out.
Potentially. It's just a technique is all that is. And that's more in line with neuromarketing. But when you start looking at the claims that might be on a menu or in a grocery store, so food that is, like I said, farm-raised, the all-natural claim, the claims that lack measure and meaning, that quite frankly are unregulated, and it's the superfoods, it's the sustainable foods. If it's not a measurable claim, then it shouldn't be used.
So that's really the key then, is measurability. If you can't measure it, then you're using it for offensive warfare or bullying almost. Now, you speak a lot to agriculture audiences. You speak to probably the National Corn Growers Association and the soybean people and cattle dairy farmers and whatnot. Now, are they subject to being bullied too?
Richard,
as far as the different farmers?
Yes, exactly. I mean, are farmers being bullied in the same respect as we city people are being bullied?
I think that you can make that claim that farmers are being bullied, but more importantly, farmers are having choices removed from them, whether it's in how to best take care of their animals, the products that are best for their land, the contracts in which they are forced to sign. For example, I have a friend here in Indiana who strongly prefers growing GMO crops and using that technology. But because he has contracts for non-GMO products, he has to go back to using some of the products that he does not consider to be safe. And those contracts are much more financially lucrative, so they made that decision. But I think it's also important to note for anybody in agriculture.
That's a business decision. That really isn't being bullied, is it? I mean, he has a choice.
It's about removing choice. And what I was also going to say is that I think it's important for agriculture folks to take a look in the mirror and ask, are you expecting people to farm just like you? One of the examples that I used in the book is a farmer, Ryan Weeks in Nebraska, who farms several thousand acres.
Okay, can you hold that story? Because it sounds like it's a good story coming, and I don't want to split it with a commercial break. So we're going to take a quick commercial break. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we're talking about food bullying. And you and I both know that we're always getting bullied these days. It just seems to be the norm up and down the food chain. With us today, we have Michelle Payne, author of Food Bullying, How to Avoid Buying BS. And it's not that BS, it's, what is it, Michelle?
Bullspeak.
There you go, bullspeak. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, much, much more. We have a great story coming up from Michelle Payne, who is author of Food Bullying, How to Avoid Buying Bullspeak, or BS. Go ahead with your fun story.
Sure. Well, I don't know if it's a fun story, but it is a real-life story. Ryan Weeks in Nebraska is a farmer who had shared his story with me. He has been very active in the social media advocacy scene, has been a farmer that I've known for many years. I've been on his farm, know his family, and he does a great job. And he's made the choice, a business choice, over the last few years to transition to organics. And he first did so because it was strictly a business choice, and then he's found some benefits to his soil health and whatnot. And he shared some pretty substantial stories of bullying where his neighbors have engaged in name calling. There's the ostracization and there's the exclusion from activities because they don't agree that he should be farming organically. And I just want to make note to friends in agriculture is that there are many different ways to farm, and all sizes and shapes of farm should be acceptable. And it's okay if our neighbors are making different decisions than what we are.
Well, that's kind of you, but what if they don't think so?
What if who doesn't think so? Our neighbors?
Well, and that seems to be a condition of our society right now, is where we're sharply divided on just about anything and everything. And if you're not doing what I think is right, then you shouldn't be doing it at all. So we're so imbued with this divisiveness now that what should happen, you know, is exactly what you say should happen is right. All farms are essentially different. Each one of them is kind of as unique as the thumbprint of its farmer. And yet we insist that some farms should be more like the ones we think they should be. How do you stand up to bullying?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to stand up to bullying, and I can talk about the specific steps that we can take to do that. But I think when it comes to farming and making choices of how to farm, that it's a deeply personal choice, as is selecting food for our families. And we need to be able to accept that others do make different choices. And just because you farm one way in California doesn't make it be the right way in Indiana. And likewise, you know, I admittedly have a very strong bias towards beautiful black and white Holstein cows, but that doesn't make a listener wrong if they happen to have Angus. It's just different. Mm-hmm. And the point is, in all of this, is to know what your own standards are, whether you're a consumer trying to determine what's the right thing for you amongst the 200,000 plus claims that you see in the grocery store, or whether it's a farmer trying to figure out what on earth to do in this economy to be able to sustain your business into future generations. It's about knowing your standards and being able to use those.
And you talk a lot about, of course, in your book, how Food Bullying, How to Avoid Buying BS. But some of the BS that you suggest can be found in the labeling of foods that are free from things. Free from gluten, free from preservatives, and so on. Free from being genetically engineered. Is that a form of bullying that you see?
Well, what I call the absence labels or the absent claims are fairy tales. Because the reality is there's only a dozen foods that are truly genetically modified. And by the way, everyone should know that, thank goodness, there is a BE label, bioengineered label, that is going to be required by 2022. That's going to be mandated by the government, which will clearly show any foods that have bioengineering, and hopefully it will do away with the money-making GMO or non-GMO labels. And so when you take a look at non-GMO labels, I use the example of peppers. I like the bags of peppers that are the latest and greatest convenience vegetable, and I intentionally will buy the ones that do not have the non-GMO label on it because I know there are no GMO peppers available.
And so that's almost like bullying with a lie then, right? That you put a non-GMO label on a pepper that there is no GMO with. So it's almost a lie.
Well, it's clearly a fairy tale, and I would consider it to be bullspeak. Likewise, I would say the claims of antibiotic-free that some people like to put on meat or milk, if you are buying USDA-approved meat or milk in the grocery store in the United States, it has been tested for antibiotics. And as such, all of them are the same, whether they carry that claim or not. Hormone-free is another fairy tale because, obviously, we all have hormones in it. Our food all has hormones in it, including that maple syrup that you enjoyed on breakfast.
And milk.
So I think it's a real challenge.
But the difference, I think, though, is that people are afraid of bovine growth hormone. So when they say antibiotic-free, that's what they're hoping for, correct?
I think you're actually referring to hormone free if you're talking about RBST.
Oh, yeah, right.
And the reality is there is very little fluid milk available in the United States that has RBST in it. But the challenge is helping people understand that hormones are the chemical messengers of life. They're required for life. Hormones are okay. You have them, I have them. And it's really interesting to take a look at some of the hormone claims that are out there, because they truly have been painted as what I call Maleficent in the book. And it's the story, it's the horrible story that truly is out there trying to bully people and capitalize on their fear about hormones. Whereas I firmly believe if a lot of people understood more about hormones, they wouldn't be so scared of them.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we lack that scientific basis to understand some of the issues such as hormones.
Well, we certainly do lack that education. The difference without distinction, what does that mean?
A difference without distinction is where they try to position a product as different in order to basically sell it for more money. But there's no distinguishable value difference or no distinguishable nutritional difference in it. And so, for example, we could talk about eggs, which I know is a very emotional issue for many people, but science clearly shows that, in fact, there is no particularly right way to have chickens that produce eggs. There are advantages to cages. There are advantages to free range. There are advantages to enriched colonies. And so when people make housing claims on packages of chickens, that's difference without distinction. Because in reality, is there's benefits to any of those systems. And likewise, when a food is a label slapped on it like cleansing, there is no measurable difference in what is truly a cleansing food and what isn't. It's a fad. It's bullspeak.
Unless one has a whole bunch of fiber and the other doesn't, that might make a difference in cleansing.
Right, but our bodies are naturally inclined to cleanse anyhow, and I think that's the point of any dietitian that I've ever interviewed for the book or for the Food Bullying podcast, is that we naturally are cleansing products. We are naturally cleansing beings. That's the function of the human mm-hmm. body. And there is no measurable, definable cleansing food out there. So if it was a fiber claim, absolutely. And in the Food Bullying book, I talk about some of the different label claims that are legitimate and that are measurable, that are meaningful. And one of those is the whole grain stamp, as an example, if you want to talk about fiber. And the standards are defined and explains the grain value for each serving.
There, once again, you're saying that you got to be measurable to be real.
Yes, measurable equals meaningful.
And otherwise, it's BS.
I would tend to say so, yes. Okay. And the reality is that FDA has called upon food processors and manufacturers for years to do a better job with the label claims that are made on packages. Unfortunately, that improvement has not necessarily happened yet. So what I always recommend to people as you're evaluating your food, flip it over and look at the very unsexy black and white box, what color it typically is, known as the nutrition facts label. That's the factual information that you need to know.
Are you telling us that the word natural might be a BS word?
I would definitely say natural, or all natural in particular, is a BS word, because how is your all natural, let's say sirloin, superior to my unlabeled hamburger? It's a claim that is BS, because the fact that all food that I know of starts from a natural source. What happens to that food in the processing or what you do with it in your own kitchen may make it more unnatural, but it's still an all-natural food in its origins.
Then what about the label organic?
So organic is actually monitored and measured by the USDA. So if it's a USDA organic seal on it, it does in fact have protocol in place. there's a lot of misunderstanding out there. People think that organic means that no chemicals were used. And as I like to say, where food grows, bugs go. And there's a lot of bugs out in California for sure. The reality is that most food has had some sort of insecticide, natural, man-made, so forth. And so the USDA organic seal is a legitimate seal. It does have measure and it does have meaning, but again, it's about choice. Mm-hmm. And that's a choice that I think every farmer and every consumer has to make based upon facts versus perception.
It seems like there is a never-ending war going over on the meaning of words. And I take organic for one word, whereas when the word was first laid on the table for consideration to become something real, which is to say backed by law, the word meant essentially biodynamic or biologically intensive soil growing systems. But through the years, the word has been put upon by, you know, those people who have something to sell, and they need to make it easier to be organic to sell it. So they go to Washington, D.C. and buy some government, and the word becomes something different. And therefore, does that word, I guess it's still real, though, because it's still a law.
The USDA organic seal is certainly real. It is measured. And again, I don't personally choose to buy USDA organically certified products, but it is one that is a legitimate seal, and it is managed by the USDA marketing service under their marketing standards. So per your point, I don't know that anybody was bought off, but it is a labeling term that indicates how the product was produced. And to me, it comes down to choice. Organic food and organic food production are about choice. Likewise, conventional GMO and such are about choice.
But not natural.
Natural is a marketing.
Okay, good.
Term.
So it's not a legitimate choice then.
Well, I'm not saying it's not a legitimate choice because I think all of us are buying natural products, but what I talk about in the book is that it lacks measure and meaning.
Right. Okay. Back to the measure and meaning. Does grass-fed or grain-fed have a measurable meaning? Can you measure them?
They typically do. And one of the challenges in writing Food Bullying is I went through over 500 pages of FDA, USDA, and FSIS food labeling documents. And so typically...
Now, that must have been an adventure.
Oh, it was interesting. Let's just say that. I decided not to include all of them in the book because it's impossible, but they are in the bonus materials on my website. But the challenge, I think, when you look at grass-fed and corn-fed is the percentage of an animal's life. So grass-fed isn't necessarily 100% monitored. But typically it looks at the 100% of the animal's life has been on grass. So it has not been finished out on grain, on corn, as most beef animals are. And therefore it lacks the layering down in the muscles of the fat that typically gives it a different mm-hmm. flavor. Again, it comes down to choice. I don't know that one is right and the other is wrong because at the very underpinnings of this book, it's taking a look at how food bullying is removing choice on the farm and across our eating choices. And I happen to strongly believe that food should be about nourishment and safety. And too many times people make food to be about emotion, sensationalism, and marketing, and kind of unfortunate.
Well, especially if you're the one spending the money and reaping the benefits of being bullied into buying something and eating something that's probably not very good for you, because if you don't, somebody's going to look at you and say you're a bad person, which is the essence of bullying, isn't it?
It sure is. Bullying operates from a point of privilege. It's based off of fear, as we've talked about. And I think at the end of the day that if you're able to step back and know what your own health, ethical, environmental, and social standards are, you can stand up or overcome food bullying. So many times people are hungry for that perfect food story. the beautiful bucolic images, the story of small farm makes it. And I am not against small farms. I happen to have a pretty barn on my own property here in Indiana, so I also like bucolic images. But every person has to be responsible for their own food story. And unfortunately, food bullying has made our food playground be filled with stories of others instead of our own.
Well, that's where we're going to go next after this quick break coming up. But we city people have a vision of how agriculture should look. That doesn't always look like that. But does that make it mean and bad? Are small farms better than big farms? Wow, that's a subject we can tear into. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What with Michelle Payne, author of Food Bullying, How to Avoid Buying BS. And we all know what BS is, right? Okay, we will be right back after these messages. Please do stay tuned.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Folks, this is the Food Chain, Michael Olson with Michelle Payne, author of Food Bullying, How to Avoid Buying BS. Bull speak. And we hear a lot of it, don't we? Everywhere we look and everywhere we listen. Michelle talks a lot about size and the bullying of big farms versus little farms. And I suppose I have engaged in that because I advocate for metropolitan agriculture. And in metropolitan settings, there really aren't any big farms because there's not any big parcels of land for big farms. But if you go out to the heartland where Michelle Payne lives, there's some big farms, some very big farms. I recall working with a farm in North Dakota that had, I think, 10,000 acres of corn and soybeans. It was like an ocean of crops. And that certainly was a magnificent piece of business. So with respect to size, I guess it really does matter where the farm is and what it's doing. Right, Michelle?
Well, I guess I would come back and ask the question, how is big bad and small bucolic? I have met great farmers that farm 10 acres in inner city. I have met great farmers that farm 10,000 acres across the world. And a farmer is a farmer is a farmer. And if somebody is producing food in a commercial way to feed others, not just being a gardener, helping provide their friends and family, but actually commercially producing food, then they're a farmer. And I'm not one that really cares what label you slap on it. I think that we can do a much better job in agriculture of working together, big and small, organic and conventional, animal agriculture and produce and the like.
And how do we start doing that? How do we start doing a better job?
Well, I think it gets back to, number one, understanding how to meet in the middle of the plate to avoid some of those food fights. And secondly, employing information literacy skills and critical thinking skills. So information literacy is really important today, given the vast amounts of volumes of information that go in front of our eyes every single day. And really knowing what it is that you're looking at and being able to critically evaluate it and then applying that information effectively. And hopefully without having your biases get in the way, because we all know we have mm-hmm. lots of biases. But critical thinking really at the end of the day is the fundamental challenge that we have. Again, whether it's food and farming we're talking about, whether it's science, it's about being able to really look at critical thinking critically.
Mm-hmm. You know, I once had the opportunity of speaking to the International Biotech Convention. It was a panel on genetically engineered foods. And how I got there, I don't know, but I was there along with the president of the American Corn Growers Association and mm-hmm. the soybean people and the hog growers and whatnot. And the audience consisted of those people who are working on genetically engineering crops. And, you know, the people who were representing the farmers stood up and expressed their appreciation for those who were genetically doing the genetic modifications. And when it came my turn to give my summation, I just said, thank you, you know, because as a teenage herbicide, I know how miserable it is to spend your summers out there in the fields hoeing weeds. And what you folks have done with your genetically engineered crops is to make it possible for one person to grow 10,000 acres of crops with no weeds or no pests. It's amazing stuff. And you've made yourself very rich, and the farmer's very happy, and everybody's happy. But sooner or later, I said, the consumers of your food are going to come to you with a question. And the question is going to be, hey, what's in this food for us? Other than food that has been genetically engineered to be infused with pesticides and drenched in herbicides. And what's in it for us? And how can agriculture answer that question in a way that is measurable?
Well, I think when you take a step back and you look at the big picture of genetics, they have done amazing things.
Absolutely.
For consumers and farmers alike, but we haven't told the story. So Arctic apples, clearly an apple that could reduce food waste, an apple that could improve fruit consumption, because we all know we don't get enough fruits and vegetables, especially children. Arctic apple, if you're not aware, has the browning gene turned off, more or less, for simple explanation, so it doesn't turn brown. So you can have apple slices that stay good in your lunch all day. Likewise, the CRISPR technology with mushrooms has done that. So there's stories like that that have very real applications to the people that are out there making eating choices. But unfortunately, we haven't told those stories. Mm-hmm. GMO is one of those very emotional, contentious points of discussion. And it's a challenge to get people to truly critically evaluate where we are with genetic engineering. And rather than talking about how pesticides and herbicides are, quote, being poured on, there are numbers out there that clearly show a reduction in carbon footprint and a reduction mm-hmm. in herbicide usage and so forth because of genetics. But we can't lead with those stories, because when you have a population who largely is disconnected from the farm and has been taught to not necessarily trust the practice of farming, the real challenge. And then you combine that, it gets back to science literacy. You combine that with a population that the vast majority think their food should be labeled if it has DNA in it. How can you explain bioengineering when you have people who don't know that their food that has DNA in it?
Well, I guess that's the question I was asking of the people who are doing the genetic modification and the farmers who use their crops. You know, you have a population of people who don't understand. All they know is that it's making it possible to have their food covered in pesticides. And so they ask the question out of naivete or what have you, but it's a question. So how can agriculture come to grips with this? Well, they have to come to, they have to bring a story. And I don't see them doing
it. Agriculture understands, from my experience in working with a whole lot of agricultural groups and food groups as well, but agriculture understands that we need to do a better job of engaging in the conversation. And one of the examples that I offer towards the end of the book is that we all have to be responsible for building our own food story. You know, I'm a farm girl from Michigan originally. I grew up with dairy cattle. I still had dairy cattle today. I've lived in California. I've worked around the world. And I thought I knew my food story. And what I've discovered is that food story has evolved over time. And part of that is knowing the source, knowing the science, and knowing the system. And so agriculture, if we can help people understand the source of their food and connect with them connect with others on a more emotional basis, I think it would go a long way to have discussions about contentious issues such as GMOs.
Well, that's one of the things I say about with respect to metropolitan agriculture is because people have the opportunity to actually look at the farmer and see what's in the food by looking into his eyes. You have that proximity. But when you live a long way away from the source of your food, you don't know who's growing it, and it becomes ever more distant, and pretty soon you're buying food from China, and you don't have any idea what's in your food. So it seems to me if agriculture could figure out a way of getting closer to the customers, they might have that opportunity.
Perhaps, but there's also the reality of being able to produce enough food to feed a growing population. And I'm not against urban agriculture, metropolitan agriculture, but I would urge everyone to remember that there is no one right answer.
Of course, you know, if you're going to be growing soybeans, it would be ridiculous to grow it in a metropolitan setting because it's so much easier
And I guess my point is that critical thinking will show you that there's no one right answer. Farmers markets are great. Urban agriculture is great. Commodity agriculture is also great. Small farms are great. Large farms are great. There are benefits.
Well, wait a minute. Which ones are bad?
That's the point, is why do we have to have a bad sort of farm? Certainly there are bad actors. I am never going to deny that. There are people out there that don't take care of their land and animals, but the vast majority that I have ever seen, which are thousands and thousands of farmers across the world, they do a great job of producing an incredibly safe food supply for us. And I would really urge you, before you fear your food, to, again, know the source or know the science or know the system that's in place to protect you.
How about the tough ethical questions, like the vegans ask of those who eat meat, for example? How can you be so cruel to eat meat, to take the life, to put an animal in a factory and raise it in these cruel, harsh, miserable conditions?
Well, I'm glad that you asked about ethics, because it's one of the four standards that I had mentioned to overcome bullying. And this is my ethical standard that I actually wrote in the book. And it was a really interesting exercise to go through my own health, ethical, environmental, and social standards and write them down, because it became very clear to me why I fundamentally believe some of the things that I do. And clearly, I have dairy animals. They provide milk, and at the end of their life, they provide meat. And it is a true honor and privilege to care for those animals. But at the end of the day, that's their purpose. And so what I wrote is my ethical standard. Just as an example, is I believe that animals in the earth deserve honorable care, but I do not value either above humans. I believe ethics in food should include taking responsibility for a safe product, seeking truth from experts, and identifying more honest marketing. And then I go on and say that I take ethical issue with those who try to bully others at any level, particularly those who slander farmers and ranchers in order to advance their narrow self-serving agendas. I have a strong ethical belief that if you are slandering a group such as a farmer, that you are unquestionably a bully. And my question would be, why? If you choose to be a vegan, I have no problem with that. I have any number of vegan friends. But if you're trying to push the world into eating exactly how you do, why? And if that involves slandering farmers and ranchers, you're bullying.
I sometimes wonder if there isn't a reason that vegan people don't want animals to be raised in confined situations. And I wonder if it's because they look at the way we live. We city people, we're like animals in a confined animal feeding operation. If you think about it.
You do realize that since I sit in a place where I see nothing except for my own cattle, I probably can't really speak to that. But in all seriousness, confinement of animals is for their own benefit. So we have horrid winters here. You know, sometimes it's negative 20 wind chill. Up north, it's worse than that. My animals are in a barn in the winter for their own protection, because if you've ever had frostbitten nipples, you would understand how painful it is. I mean, there is a
and that's no BS, right?
Right. And there's a reason why animals are confined, and it's not just to be cruel. If you know animals, you know how to evaluate their health, their happiness, and their satisfaction. And when my animals are uncomfortable, I'm uncomfortable because I have an ethical responsibility to care for them. And anybody in animal agriculture would say exactly the same thing.
And I sometimes think that, just being so far removed from animals when you're living in the city, that you think they should have this wonderful existence of dancing around a, clover-strewn pasture or something like that. But life isn't like that all the time. And winter does come, and you have to protect them. And so you have to put them away.
Well, and my cow is not your dog. I think that's an important point to make, that my cow is not your dog. You know, I have a dog. She happens to live in the pasture with the cattle because she's a Great Pyrenees and she is very strongly bonded to them. But I also have a house cat who lives the life of luxury. But she's not a cow. She's a companion animal. And there is a distinct line between companion animals and animals that are designed for food production. It does not mean that farm animals are treated cruelly. They are treated with as much compassion. But the practices that we use in animal agriculture deserve to have context added around them to understand what sometimes looks to be really cruel, but is done in the best interest of the animal.
Well, you're one great warrior for agriculture, and I was honored to have you on the Food Chain Radio Show today. How do people get tuned in with Michelle Payne?
Thanks for connecting with me. I sure appreciate it. You can catch me at causematters.com. My social handle, and I'm on about all of the channels, is M Payne Speaker. So M-P-A-Y-N-S-P-E-A-K-E-R. And I'm always happy to connect with any of your listeners, answer any questions. You can also go to foodbullying.com. to learn more about the book, which releases November 5th. I'm super excited, and it should be available at any of the major bookstores near you as well as online.
And you like to speak, right?
Yes, I am a professional speaker, so always happy to work with any of the ag groups. And, it's not all bad coming out.
Thank you so much, Michelle Payne. Think we ran out of time, but so much fun. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.